Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to a new episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. On today's episode, we're doing things a little different. I have two interviews today. The first is with Einat Wilf, former senior fellow at JPPI, a former member of Knesset, but more important, a great Zionist thinker and the co-author of The War of Return, a book that argues that for the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians to end with peace, Palestinians must come to terms with the fact that there will be no right of return. I spoke to Einat because of the controversy surrounding the United Nations Relief Work Agency, UNRWA, which broke out this week after Israel revealed that employees of the so-called aid organization participated in the October 7th massacre. I then speak with retired Brigadier General Amir Avivi, head of the Israel Defense and Security Forum, otherwise known in Israel as the Bitchonistim, group of about 16,000 reserve officers and operatives from all branches of Israeli security forces who say that they work to guide the narrative of Israel's national security needs and ensure that Israel's security is never taken for granted. Amir and I spoke about the ongoing ground offensive in Gaza and what we should expect to come next. Here we go. Einat, it's great to have you for a one-on-one conversation. We've had you on so many panels, but I wanted to talk to you because obviously UNRWA is so much in the headlines right now. You wrote the book on it. We see it behind you, The War of Return. First of all, you know, let me just say, like, personally, it's obviously horrifying to hear about this and read this, but I'm guessing you weren't surprised, right? I mean, the writing's been on the wall about UNRWA for a long time.
Of course. UNRWA, once you understand what UNRWA is and not what the facade of UNRWA is, that UNRWA essentially first is a Palestinian organization, cleverly hid behind the letters UN and a few French and Swiss managers, but it's a Palestinian organization for Palestinians for the purpose of keeping the war of 1948 as an open case. So once you understand that this is the purpose of UNRWA, and you begin to understand the scale of UNRWA in kind of indulging and supporting and sustaining and giving rise not just to a unique Palestinian nationalism as opposed to other Arab ones, but to a Palestinian nationalism that is singularly focused on the idea of return, on the idea of liberating Palestine from the river to the sea, on the idea of revenge. Once you understand that this is what the organization does, then you can't be surprised that generation after generation, it gives rise to terrorist organizations from Black September, which carried out the massacre of the Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. They are the outcome of UNRWA schools and the UNRWA compounds, all the way now to the perpetrators as well as the planners of the October 7th massacre. Once you understand what UNRWA is, you cannot be surprised by what it does.
Now, UNRWA, when it was established, right, the United Nations Relief Work Agency, one of the absurdities has always been, at least I've always thought, was, you know, there's the Commission for Refugees at the United Nations, but the Palestinians got their own agency on the one hand. And then in addition to that, this is passed on from generation to generation to generation, right? Can you talk about how did this come into being even?
Certainly. So just like an airplane is a wonderful machine, but then when it gets hijacked, it could become a weapon. UNRWA started with the best intentions. It was established as a temporary agency. That was not unique. At about the same time, there was UNCRA for the Koreans, because the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in the early 50s, late 40s, was mostly focused on Europe and the refugees from World War II. So there's nothing special in creating a temporary agency for a specific conflict. The idea being, in 3 to 4 years, they'll settle everybody and move on. That's actually what happened in Korea. 2 million Korean refugees, three times the numbers of the Arab refugees, were settled in a few short years, a third of the budget of UNRWA. And look at South Korea today. Could have been the Palestinians. But the Palestinians were like, absolutely not. If we settle, it means that the war is over. And if the war is over, then the Jewish state gets to stay. That's unacceptable. So what they were able to do really with some far-reaching thinking, which they seem to only employ when it comes to fighting Israel, they did two things. First, they ensured that rather it was first going to be called RIWA or NERWA, it would be called UNRWA. So the letters UN will be there, signifying that the UN is responsible for the mess. They are not responsible. They went to war, has nothing to do with them. And second, they secured a loophole, an exception. When the UNHCR was established, the Arabs understood that if the Arab refugees, now recast as Palestinians, but if the Arab refugees from the War 48 would be settled like the Germans and Ukrainians and Poles and Hindus and Muslims and everyone else from that era, within a few years, there's no Arab refugees. And again, that means that the war is over. So they secured a loophole that said, UNHCR takes care of everybody, except those who have an agency already. And then the Arabs went to ensure that UNRWA will never close. And that's how they created this closed loophole fiefdom of UNRWA, which then became hijacked once the Arabs were able to secure that it will never close until they can secure return and no Jewish state. They basically hijacked it and took it over and made it into this Palestinian organization that secures the Palestinian goal of no Jewish state.
So it's been weaponized essentially as a weapon to undermine Israel and to continue to wage war, you know, until they actually participate as terrorists, but mostly on a diplomatic level against Israel.
It's more fundamental than that. It's not just their participation. They are the entire education, welfare system of the Palestinian people waiting for the Jewish state to disappear. That's essentially their role. And their role is to send a message to Palestinians every day, do not move on with your lives. Don't build anything. Don't compromise. Don't create a state for yourself next to the Jewish state. Wait, keep fighting, because this Jewish state is temporary. That's the message that everyone going through the UNRWA schools essentially gets. That's the entire purpose of UNRWA. That's why it exists. Everything else that it does is essentially busy work to keep busy while it's waiting for Israel to no longer exist.
So, first of all, it's also important to keep in mind, UNRWA also, it's not just Gaza, right? UNRWA is in places like the West Bank, it's in Jordan, it's in Syria, it's in Lebanon. I mean, it's anywhere that you might have Palestinian refugees and these Palestinian refugee camps. And the absurdity also, of course, is that like the Palestinians in Lebanon, how many are there who live there, for example?
So officially, there's about 500,000, but we know by now that 2/3 of them left. But UNRWA doesn't register that. It doesn't take them off the books.
And they don't get Lebanese citizenship, right? They stay these refugees. So they're like, that's apartheid, right? If we ever talk.
Absolutely. From all the countries, Lebanon is the one that really has an actual apartheid system, because it has a system of laws designed to ensure not only that these are Arab-born Lebanese, but they are stateless. They are denied Lebanese citizenship because of the idea that they need to be kept as this weapon for the undoing of the Jewish state. And there's a bunch of laws ensuring that those Arab-born Lebanese will never become true Lebanese.
So I understand why the Palestinians would want this. I understand why our enemies would want this. But why would the UN and why would the world and America, right? We just saw, you know, with the reports that are coming out, America is their largest donor. $340 million, I think I read somewhere. I mean, they're getting money from every country around the world. Why would these countries allow this system to perpetuate itself? Why don't they use the money to leverage change?
So the initial process was merely one of caving in to threats. When the Arab countries decided that they wanted to keep UNRWA open as a way of keeping this kind of question mark over Israel's existence. And in real time, we describe it in the book, they say to the Americans, you made one mistake. You allowed Israel to come into being. You don't want to make the mistake of closing UNRWA. So from the beginning, UNRWA was the offset to the fact that Israel exists. This was the idea how ultimately Israel will cease to exist. So this is the 50s. This is the Cold War. Oil is important. So basically, the West, this is the US and UK at this point, cave into Arab pressure, and they essentially pay protection the way that you pay to the mob.
So they wouldn't attack them, they would do that? Was that the idea?
The idea was like, we don't want to make the Arabs angry. This seems to make them angry. We're not going to close UNRWA if it's so important for them. This is peanuts. And we'll just keep paying that money, really the way you pay protection to the mob. But then over time, as it becomes this Palestinian organization, it also begins to engage in this diplomatic battle to turn what I call Palestinianism into a theology. The idea that these are poor, miserable victims who are only the victims of pure evil, and the West is responsible for their plight. They are never responsible for anything. They are never agents of history. They never engage in wars. They're just victims. And they've built that story, and a lot of people buy into it. And there's this notion that you pay into UNRWA as a way of like supporting the poor Palestinians. And one of the things I really hope happens after October 7th is an end to the poor Palestinian mythology. I mean, if we've seen anything on October 7th, that required massive investment in infrastructure, economic and financial planning, discipline, training, strategy, vision of a perverse kind, but vision. These are a people with capabilities. It's just that for a century, they've decided to devote their capabilities to destroying the Jewish state rather than building something for themselves. And UNRWA is at the core of it.
So let me play devil's advocate for a moment. The world will say, but there are the miskanim, the poor Palestinian people, and they're suffering, and they need help, and we have to continue to provide them with this assistance. I mean, if there's no UNRWA, and UNRWA, of course, and there are officials who are already saying, I've been reading all day about how if they don't get the money by February, everything will collapse and there will be a calamity of humanitarian disaster proportions in the Gaza Strip. What's the alternative? Or do we not really care?
So do you know those people who always say that we're on the verge of disaster, it never happens? This is UNRWA. UNRWA always goes in crisis mode. And again, the whole mythology of the poor Palestinians is how they keep themselves as this facade for the actual Palestinian goal. But really, we need to understand the Palestinians are not an incapable people. They are simply a people with screwed priorities, prioritizing no Jewish state over building something for themselves. When people ask, how will they have education? How will they have healthcare without UNRWA? Well, in the same way that all other people in the world have education and healthcare without a dedicated agency that perpetuates their idea that they should never come to terms with the results of a war that ended 75 years ago. I was interviewed about recently and someone said, everybody's asking the same question. How will they take care of themselves? And I said, I'll introduce you to a shocking idea. They can build schools. They can educate. I mean, we really should stop buying into the poor Palestinians' mythology. They just need to have different priorities. And that's the thing. They will never have different priorities. They will never snap out of, oh, we need to get rid of the Jewish state or in Palestine from the river to the sea. They will never snap out of that if the West continues to fuel and indulge their notion that the war of 1948 is not over, that into the fifth generation, they're still refugees from that war, and that they have only one noble goal in life, which is to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. They'll never move on.
All this news that has come out and the clear complicity to some extent of UNRWA workers, definitely. But we know about the incitement and the education system and their camps that they've run all these years where they teach kids how to kill Jews and things like that, done inside UNRWA schools and whatever. You've studied this extensively. Are you optimistic that this is maybe going to be a watershed moment, or are you thinking we'll just go back to the way things were?
It's a moment of opportunity, like a lot of things as a result of October 7th. But everything depends on Israel. For years, if not decades, Israel put an iron dome over UNRWA under the mistaken view that UNRWA is a moderating force in the region. UNRWA is actually the most radicalizing force in the region because it perpetuates this conflict. So there was this mistaken notion that we can purchase quiet, that UNRWA is a moderating force. Rather, it was exactly the opposite. Generation after generation, it built a greater machine of hate, a greater machine that would ensure that peace is never possible. So the question is, has Israel changed course? The fact that Israel gave this material, released this material, opens the possibility that Israel did a 180. I'm talking to people. There seems to still be a battle about Israel within Israel. There's a lot of forces pushing to go back to the way things are. There's still a sense in the American administration that I really don't understand that they've suddenly become these fanatic champions of UNRWA. But if Israel will stand up and say, there can never be a positive day after, not just for Gaza, for the region, for us and for the Palestinians, if there is an organization that keeps telling the Palestinians, never compromise, never agree to there being a Jewish state, you are refugees, you have a right of return. Israel has to say that and has to make it clear that nothing good can happen in this region until this organization is gone, dismantled, and Palestinians are finally held up to the same standard of all refugees from wars throughout the 20th century.
Another big decision for the leadership in this country to make, and it falls very much in. I like how you kind of tied it together. It also has to do with the general policy that we've had towards the Gaza Strip and Hamas over the last, you know, bunch of years that led to a large extent to what happened here on October 7th. Einat Wilf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amir Avivi, retired Brigadier General, it's great to have you with us on the JPPI podcast. Thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So we're talking already pretty much almost 115 days into the war. Things to some extent seem like they are getting a little stuck in the mud of Gaza. The government seems to be speaking out of two sides of its mouth. On the one hand, it wants a deal for the hostages. On the other hand, it wants to continue until a complete victory. Do you think both of these are at all possible?
I think both are possible, and I think they complement each other. In order to bring back the hostages, you need to win against Hamas. You need to create a reality where Hamas is under military pressure. It's only the ground incursion that will create the terms needed to bring back the hostages. I don't think we're that far away from destroying Hamas. We need to finish destroying the Khan Yunis Brigade, and we are on the verge of doing that. We need to do the ground incursion also in Rafah and finish what is left in the central camps. I think overall, Hamas is beaten. The IDF is winning in every encounter. And we need to develop, I think, one more major attack in order to really managed to reach the goals of war, which is bringing down Hamas as a governmental and military entity, and also create the terms to bring back the hostages.
Amir, you as the head of the Bitronis team, you've been pushing, I would say, on the more aggressive side for this victory, for Israel to continue not to stop, not to surrender to pressure from the international community. We know that there has been a lot of pressure. You mentioned Rafah. Until now, Israel hasn't been there. Right. Israel has not gone in there. The Egyptians don't want them to. Do you think that the government here is doing enough, the Israeli government?
I think that the government and also the military commander understand that you cannot win the war without taking control of Rafah. You need to stop the endless flow of weapons and capabilities that is going through this border with Egypt into Gaza. Only when Israel will also control all the humanitarian aid and will be responsible of spreading it, then we'll be able to take from Hamas its power over the society. So this is crucial in order to really achieve the goals of war. You cannot dismantle Hamas without stopping the flow of weapons and capabilities that are coming from the Egyptian border, and also taking from Hamas the power of controlling the society through the distribution of the humanitarian aid.
You know, on the one hand, you mentioned, and I completely agree with you, that Israel, the IDF and all of its encounters, comes out and defeats the Hamas in all of the battles that it engages with them. On the other hand, we're 115 days pretty much into this war, and Hamas is still able to attack. It's still able to fire anti-tank missiles. It's still able to fire rockets occasionally. Are you surprised at all by Hamas's resilience and ability to keep standing and fighting?
Not really, I think. They build a huge force, almost 40,000 terrorists, with a very elaborate underground infrastructure. They're able to survive in the underground, and it took the IDF some time to really develop the techniques to fight also underground and not only above ground. Every company, every battalion of Hamas, they are completely self-sufficient, and they don't need any outside assistance. And this is the way Hamas build all its forces. So this is a process. I think the IDF is doing it fast, considering the reality that it has encountered. And again, I think it's only a matter of time until Hamas will be destroyed.
Amir, I want to get your impression on the United States, right? We saw in the beginning of the war, Biden gave those speeches, sent the aircraft carriers to the region. What has your impression been lately with these calls by the U.S. for a two-state solution, as if pushing Israel back into that same pigeonhole that we used to be in before?
Well, I think that on one hand, I think there is a clear understanding in the administration that Israel must win decisively against Hamas. And this is crucial not only for Israel, but for the whole West, and also for the U.S. capability to really be relevant in the Middle East. This is why we see the flow of capabilities going on all the time, assisting Israel, also helping Israel in the UN Security Council. But I think that the administration is stuck with a solution that has no future, that is disconnected from the reality on the ground.
Yeah.
I don't see any two-state solution, certainly not the two-state solution the administration is pushing. I think that only in Gaza we'll have a long, long period of time that Israel will have to control this place. It's not different from what we saw in the end of the Second World War, when the U.S. And its allies defeated the Nazis, and then you had in Germany 4 years of military control and denazification before the U.S. transferred to the Germans civil control. Why would it work differently in this case?
It's so here similar. We need, you spoke about denazification in Europe. Here we need de-radicalization. And sometimes it seems that, you know, the plans that are on the table for the day after just talk about, let's get somebody in there, let's get somebody to take over, stabilize Gaza, but not about de-radicalization. And without de-radicalization, we'll just be back where we are now in a few years, no?
Yeah, and this is why we need to do exactly what the U.S. did at the end of the Second World War in Japan and in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take responsibility for a certain period of time. We need to deal with the education. We need to find, it's not easy, to build local leadership that is not Hamas, not Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and also not the Palestinian Authority that is as bad as both of them. I mean, also, the Palestinian Authority is devoted to the destruction of Israel. It's inciting in schools.
Right.
So finding and building a new leadership, this will take time. So, you know, people talk about the day after, but it's really you have the day after, and then you have the day after the day after. It's a process. It's not one shot. The day after, there can be only one solution. This is Israel. Taking responsibility. How long? We don't know. We saw how long it took in Europe.
Right.
So
the problem is sometimes it seems that the West wants quick solutions. And what you're saying is that here, there is no quick solution.
No, not at all. It's a process, and we have to all realize that, because if we won't, this will fail, and also this will distance them dramatically also any vision that the West has about a solution. We really need to you know, do the same process the U.S. did with the Nazis. And it's a long process. It's not going to be short. And also from a military point of view, just dismantling all this military buildup that Hamas did, this will take years. Yeah. I mean, just this week, it was published that something like 80% of the tunnels haven't been destroyed. This is going to take a very long time.
I want to ask you, Boshe, before I let you go, about the North, Israel and Hezbollah. There's a mini war that's been raging there also since October 7th. How do you see that playing out? Is there any alternative to a larger scale conflict? Is there any other way for that to end?
So I think the first thing to understand is that we must defeat Hamas completely. We must eradicate Hamas even before we talk about the North. And I think the sooner the better. I think the IDF, you know, should operate with more forces in Gaza at the moment to really achieve the goals of war. Talking about the North, I think that after defeating Hamas, probably the most wise thing to do, and I know that the government is working with the administration on that, is going back to the normalization with Saudi Arabia, building a coalition, an international coalition, an American-Israeli-Sunni coalition, possibly also with Britain, France, because we have to deal with the whole Iranian octopus. We have to deal with Iran, with the Houthis, with the militias in Iraq, with Hezbollah. And I think that approaching these challenges with a coalition creates maybe a bigger chance to really manage to get Hezbollah to withdraw from South Lebanon, according to Resolution 1701. Without a credible military threat, without a strong international pressure, I think that we'll find ourselves really having to go to war, and this war might become not only a local war between Israel and Hezbollah, but a regional war, and maybe a global one. So I think that we really need to build the infrastructure that will enable to try to stabilize the Middle East and not completely bring it into a regional and global war.
And let me just ask you one last question, Amir. You know, people tend to look at this and they get scared, right? They look at, you know, how long the war has been going on in Gaza, and obviously the death toll on the Israeli side, which is tragic and unfortunate, every soldier who's killed. And they look at Hezbollah and they hear the predictions of the rockets and missiles that they have. And what I say always is that, yes, these are significant threats, but we are much stronger. And I think sometimes that gets lost, the fact that we still are strong.
So I think that, you know, on one hand, we are definitely in a reality where war might be long, but we are definitely stronger. We are definitely going to win decisively on all fronts. And I think that the bigger the win will be, the more decisive it will be, the bigger the golden age of Israel and Jewish people will be the day after. And I'm very, very optimistic. Mm. I think that a great future awaits for Israel and the Jewish people. We got the opportunity to really deal with all our core challenges. And we need to be strong and resolute and united, and do whatever is need to do to win. And the day after, the bigger the win, the more peace agreements we'll have, the more the economy will bloom. We'll see massive aliyah to Israel. So I'm optimistic. We have an opportunity to really ensure the future of the next generations.
Amen. Amir Avivi, the head of the Bitronis team, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.